In a world of EMS podcasters, EMS Office Hours is the only live podcast bringing you the latest topics and opinions in EMS. Turn down your scanner and turn up your speakers as we join Jim Hoffman and Josh Knapp on their latest EMS podcasting journey.
Hey everybody, it's Jim Hoffman from EMS Office Hours, and of course I am here with
Josh Knapp.
Josh, I know we got a little bit of a connection thing tonight, so hopefully you'll be all right. I know normally we join each other sort of on another medium, but you dialed in tonight, which is fine. But if we get disconnected for some reason, I will get back to you and hook you up through the Skype connection or whatever. So everybody knows out there might be a little bit different. They might hear a different audio take than maybe what they might be used to hearing. So just kind of want to get that out of the way a little bit.
If it breaks down, Jim, just hang up and call me.
Yeah, you know what I mean? Absolutely.
I mean, and for some of the longtime listeners of the show, sometimes they hear things that go in and out. Jim and I hear it too. And we've been trying for the life of us to figure it out. It could be a couple of different things, but we always try to tune it so you get the best audio possible.
Yeah. It's hard to. A lot of it, I think, is the internet interference, and it might be the Blog Talk, medium. They have a lot of advertising and pop-ups and stuff, and I think that kind of might confuse the bandwidth a little bit as well, because I'm on a pretty high speed connection, so it really shouldn't be, I think, on our end, my end, but it could be a combination of things, who knows. But so Josh, you did a little exercising today?
I was out and about for a couple hours this morning, enjoying the spring-like weather that we've been gifted with. Uh-huh. I mean, it was kind of hot over the last few days. There were a few other people with me doing this thing called the New York City Triathlon.
Now, was that today? Were you just training for that today, or was the actual triathlon
today? I ran it and I did it, and I had a couple of things. It was my first time running it. I had a couple of things going on, so to learn from. But I did 3:30, which is not an unrespectable time. I was moving throughout it. I had some really good, my
swim
was 25 minutes. Yep. And a mile swim, 26 mile. Huh?
How much did you swim?
Mile swim. It's just slightly under a mile, but it was basically,
and where you swimming?
Considered a mile. And the fresh, refreshing, clean Hudson River.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Which maybe is a little bit nicer up by you.
Yeah, I think so. I think it's a little bit nicer. By the time the water gets to me, or maybe it's coming from me, going to you, it's a little cleaner.
I got to tell you, it was either the dead fish or the boards, and then there's something that just sort of raked across my leg. I don't want to even know what it's
probably
was.
A shark.
Yeah, I don't think a shark would live in there. But, when you were working down here, you fished one or two bodies out.
Oh, yeah. Well, it's funny, a lot of people say, stuff touches you in the water. It could be anything. It could be a piece of seaweed or, a little bitty baby guppy fish. And right away you're thinking it's like a giant octopus or, sharks or a great white. Great white on Hudson River, trying to get to you.
I got
Bob Sullivan on hold here. I don't want to keep him on too long. Bob, you still with us?
I'm right here, yes.
Great. Well,
is it the East River or the Hudson River that Creamer swims in?
The Hudson River is the river that runs between, because it's the East River would be its own thing, but the Hudson River runs between New York and New Jersey. So both states have had their opportunity. Hmm. Hey, listen, I'm coming down there next week, dude.
Is that next week? Okay.
Yeah. I still have to email you because I have no place to stay. So if you have any ideas.
I can probably help you with that.
I am definitely looking for just suggestions now.
Hey, Bob, didn't you just post? Was it? I didn't get a chance to read your post, Bob, on the staging with ambulances as opposed to corner on the corner. What is it? On the corner or in a station?
Yes, the post about posting.
Right. So yeah, post about posting. So I didn't get a chance to read that, but do you post at a station?
We do. We are a station-based hybrid system.
All right. So you must have a spare bed there.
Yes. Yeah. It's recliners. They're recliners.
There you go,
they're
Josh.
Actually dialysis recliners.
Oh, my God.
So, yes.
It's a new way of looking at business.
So we're told, yeah.
You know, higher-ups look at it like an annuity. You know, we say frequent flyers. They say an annuity. There's a gift that keeps on giving.
That's funny. Well, listen, guys, last week, at the end of the show last week, Dave Aber and Tim Noonan and myself kind of started getting a little bit off track with talking about protocols and deviating from protocols and, you know, the way protocols get worded. And I actually was thinking of, along the line of the show this week, I actually found a couple of articles that kind of flowed into that, and I wanted to touch base on that, but we got off on the topics and never really got around to it. So I figured, you know what, I'll go ahead and this week do a show kind of focused on protocols and deviating from them, you know, pretty much based on, I guess, what we want to do for a patient, what we feel is best for the patient versus what a protocol might tell us to do. And sort of maybe the repercussions of doing that, you know, with regards to, let's say, management or QA, QI type thing, or maybe docs in the ER and stuff like that. I'll talk about deviating from protocol. I'm not talking about doing things that, you know, is against everything that you know, we're trained to do or not in our scope of training or beyond what the protocol says. But I was reading Kelly's article, and he, you know, he mentioned something in there about how so many protocols have the words may or consider in them, how they're sort of just like throughout the entire set of protocols, but yet a lot of people kind of interpret the consider word as do it or must, you know what I mean? And it ends up that if you don't do that, it's like people start thinking that you're not working inside that protocol. So I'm kind of putting it to you guys, I guess, a little bit, just to sort of, you know, get your take on, you know, what do you do when the protocol says one thing and you feel, you know, based on your experience, based upon your assessment, based upon the, you know, the patient's presentation, that following the protocol to the letter isn't necessarily what's going to be the best for the patient. You know, how do you handle that? I mean, is it just a basic call to med control to get approval to deviate from that protocol, or is it, you know, a bigger thought process that kind of goes through your head when you consider doing that?
I think, you know, there's ones that are potentially harmful or that are potentially
right.
Questionable, and then there are ones that are just like, well, we, you know, it's like the old days in Narcan, you know, when it was like two with a repeat of two, and the first thing you were taught on the bus as a new medic was you give it until they just start breathing again or they're slightly awake, and you can start to assess them, and then there was, you know, the meaner side of that logic. But the clinical side, the practitioner side that I remember was, you know, you give enough, titrate as needed, as Tim would say. And, you know, now that there's all sorts of things, you know, in some areas where you have to give specifically to the body weight from the get-go, you know, there's no titration, et cetera. And I think, you know, it, with drugs like that, enough is what you need. I mean, if you have a diabetic and you bring them up to 120 dBL with half of an amp of D50, are you going to push the rest?
Right. Bob, any thoughts real quick?
Back to what Kelly said, I think on a, I believe it was First Few Moments about spinal immobilization. Kelly talked about how he finds his way around protocols where, okay, you fall in and you bump your head and your neck doesn't hurt, but by protocol, I need to backboard you. So what Kelly said, and I hope I'm, paraphrasing him right, that he'll say, unless you don't want me to put this collar around your neck and unless you don't want to lay on this board, if you sign here, then I don't have to do this, which is really just a charade. It's going to cause more harm than good. With the dextrose example, my protocol says to give up to 25 grams. So I know that D10 is better. I also have a general care protocol that says I can give up to 500 cc's of fluid, if I think a patient needs it.
Mm-hmm.
So what I end up doing is pushing the D50 very, very, very slowly and give them a 250 or 500 cc fluid bolus to dilute it as much as I can.
I got you.
Probably is more like, and it's sad that we need to do that, but that's where, I just think that it can be so stressful taking care of patients already, but then we have to think about what the protocol says. When we know, a few of us know better than, we're not the lowest common denominator, we know more than the protocol, and we know how some interpretations of the protocol can cause harm, that we need to think about ways around that. Narcan is one example, oxygen's another. There are too many protocols are written for the lowest common denominator by people thinking, how can we avoid having paramedics screw this stuff up?
Yeah.
It's a shame.
Bob, I have Dave in the queue. I'm going to bring him on here, too, because I know he wrote the Shade to Gray post. I want to give him an opportunity, too, to jump in here. Dave, are you on the line there?
Yep. Hey, Jim.
How's it doing? Thanks for joining us.
No problem.
Dave, you kind of motivated me a little bit for tonight's episode. So I really want to get your take on it. I think Bob makes a good point, and even with Josh mentioned too, with the Narcan, Josh, even thinking about it, years ago, the protocol was like give 2 milligrams and that was it. There was no titrating. Now it's like you titrate at, .08 or whatever, up until its effect to a maximum of 2 milligrams, So they're changing it, I guess, a little bit, which is what's better for the patient, but you still have like things like the dextrose. I think that's in a lot of places where it's you give the 25 grams, give a whole amp, and that's it. There's no room for.
But that's what I'm saying. Years ago the protocol did say give 2 milligrams, and
yeah.
The first thing you were taught when you were on the bus as a new medic, don't give the whole damn 2
right.
milligrams because you might if you
right.
have a. Right. Yeah. There's a lot of different reasons why you might not want to just push that amount of Narcan on somebody right away. And so we in the field who were smarter than the protocol, whether it be through, actual book knowledge or field experience, knew you didn't push the whole damn thing at once.
Yeah.
And, it's – go ahead.
And – I won't say what system, but I've been involved with a system before where they did push all 2, and their goal there was to get the patient alert enough to walk away from you and go to the next due district. And it's sad. It's very sad, to think that. But, I remember in my current system where I work now, when I first started, a lot of times you were pushing 2 milligrams, and I just remember these patients coming up because our protocol said push up to 2 milligrams. And just like Bob was saying, up to 25 grams of dextrose, they were pushing the 2 grams because it was quick, easy. You knew they'd wake up, but then they'd be vomiting, fighting you, and you'd have to deal with all that. It's so much easier. And actually, Narcan was what spurred the posting the 50 Shades of Grey protocols because of, when you have a patient that is not totally responsive, but they are maintaining their airway. They have adequate respirators and adequate on title, however your protocol reads. Then, you know, yeah, it might make it easier to give that little bit of Narcan to wake them up, but, you know, they also could react to it and start vomiting, and, you know, you have a lot of airway issues then. And,
you know, the way it was explained to me was that, you know, yeah, that nauseous vomiting that when you push a bunch of Narcan is the first sign, so to speak, of withdrawal. And keep in mind that withdrawal can go all the way to seizures. And so, you know, you can have potentially a sensitive enough person who is overdosed on some sort of opiate, and you push the whole thing, and it can go straight from, you know, unconscious, not breathing, to seizures. And then what do you do? And then have you caused more harm? You know, have you caused harm where we, you know, do no harm in these applications? And so sometimes you have to, you know, we're in that situation of looking past. Bringing it back to what you were saying earlier about last week, when they were talking about spinal immobilization, that's sort of that tricky road. I mean, that's using your eye as a clinician saying, listen, everything I'm looking at between mechanism of injury, patient at hand, the surrounding factors with that patient, their coherentness and everything else dictates to me that, you know, spinal immobilization is, you know, a waste of everybody's time. But the protocol says, now in certain systems, I'm one of them now, we've been under certain conditions using the Canadian system clearing spines. And I think it's, you know, a pretty smart move finally. Do we, three-quarters of our job still, if a person has a hint of alcohol under breath, that's it, you know, they bought a board. I mean,
yeah.
And, you know, who like, and then, of course, you have the person on the board, they're laying down, they were probably drunk, they've got the spins now even worse, they puke, they're strapped to a board, what happens to their airway? So if we cause more harm than good. Sorry, get off my soapbox.
Yeah, no kidding.
I just
so you'll never get. There's a perception out there, though, that if you put every patient on an outer breather mask, you won't get in trouble. If you put every patient on a backboard, medical patient, you won't get in trouble.
Right.
So, and you've gone, yeah, you know, I believe you did a show about CYA, and we're hurting people out of this belief that, okay, well, if we do the maximum, you know, we know oxygen's not benign anymore. That's finally making it into, like, the mainstream EMS education. So we do
what,
things.
Say that again. That muffled a little bit. I'm sorry.
Oxygen is not benign. This is finally making it, you know, there's Mike McAvoy has an EMS 1 article about it up now. So every patient doesn't need an outer breather, but there are still, you know, supervisors who were taught that. They haven't learned very much since their initial education, and they go read reports. Well, you had a STEMI. Why didn't you give them an outer breather? Because their pulse ox is fine, and they were breathing okay. And they can't sort of see past what they were taught.
I think that's a big part of it, too, where it's like, and I think we've said this on the show before. I know Tim has mentioned this, too. It's like we keep doing things because it's the way it's been done. And there's not enough people, I guess, that are questioning, you know, the norm. You know, but we come back to, like you just mentioned about, you know, we have the people that are above the field personnel that are reading protocols, and they're comparing the protocol versus what you wrote down and what you did on the call. And if you don't follow that to the letter, you know, now that becomes a way for them to gig you and to kick back that patient care report to you saying you deviated from the protocol. Now, I was looking at some of the other areas and looking at the other protocols out there before the show about what, you know, what you do if you deviate from the protocol. You know, they kind of give guidelines to their providers if you have to deviate from the protocol. And it's like this whole list of things that you have to do if you deviate to kind of justify
cemetery at midnight swinging a dead cat around your head.
Yeah.
Hop on 1 foot three times.
Well, that's the thing, though. But I think that the way to go and start justifying why you're deviating from that protocol ends up being so difficult and so time consuming and so frustrating that you're basically almost writing a whole another chart almost to justify giving, let's say, half an amp of dextrose for a patient because they woke up after that, you know, after the initial, you know, what, you know, half of the amp of dextrose you're going to give them. Now you have to write a whole another pretty much chart to justify that. And people say, you know what, it's easier for me to just go ahead and just give the full amp, document it as it states in the protocol. I don't have to worry about anything getting kicked back to me. I don't have to worry about justifying myself. I don't have to worry about explaining it to the hospital when I get there. You know, or even my partner who might be an old school type person who doesn't want to think about, you know, what might be better for the patient at the time. And just, you know, he might start questioning it, and I got to justify it, you know, to him or to her. You know what I mean? And I think people, you know, just sort of fall into that. It's easier just to go ahead and follow 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 and just, you know, follow those guidelines instead of questioning it.
You know, you're just describing the first layer. You know, our immediate supervisors who may scan something like this, and at least there's some attempt that you can have at justifying your moves, you know, look at the text, read the body, and everything else. But where has basically our ACRs, now that they're scannable, now that they're on computers, now that everything is digitized, what are we talking about? We're talking about a third party removed that's actually making judgment over our patient care based on the checkboxes we just filled out without a narrative.
Well, I think with electronic stuff, I think it makes it easier to a point for, let's say, people who are in charge of the, you know, quality assurance and whatever, and it makes it easier for them to sort of locate a change, locate an abnormality in what might normally be done for a patient presenting the same way.
Yeah, but a lot of times things don't even go beyond that. I mean, they've located the change. They don't read the narrative. They don't look at what's going on. Been, you know, this, why wasn't this provided during this situation? And sometimes it almost becomes a billing issue, which is nauseating.
Yeah, that's a whole other thing too, and that could be another show, you know, I can talk about documenting for billing, and, you know, don't get me started. But, you know, I think we end up with that, you know, of just sort of trying to just, you know, some people kind of get beat down, right? You get a person who, let's say they just come out of med school, and this can be for new providers a lot of times because they're fresh out of school. They've got the most latest education. They've been in, you know, around a lot of the doctors and stuff in the emergency rooms and on their rotations that kind of push the newer stuff that's happening, what's best for patients and whatnot, and they start trying to treat their patients that way, and now all of a sudden they're getting beat down because they're not following the protocol to the letter. And, of course, they're probably being scrutinized more because they're new to an agency and new to the system. And eventually, like, you know what, maybe it's not worth it. Maybe it's not worth me worrying about how much Narcan I give somebody or whether or not I put somebody on a board. It's easier to just go ahead and strap somebody to a board than sit there and try to justify why I'm not strapping them to a board. Hello?
And Jim, like, the to take that a step further, you know, if you give someone half an amp of D50, they're not going to know how much you really gave them. You can just document that you gave the whole thing and nobody would know. And it's the same with Narcan.
Right.
And it's unethical. But these kinds of, you know, the QI police and these kinds of, you know, you're going to follow the protocol no matter whether it's good or bad for the patient. It breeds that kind of behavior, and that's just, I mean, it's easier to falsify documentation, and unless there's a camera or unless your partner's there, they're never going to know, and in your heart, you know you did what's best, but it's not worth getting in trouble for.
So let me ask you something.
It's like a white lie, almost.
Well, wait a second, guys. does this almost encourage a blinder ideology when it comes to what we do? Like, if you know too much, it's not something good for your career. So just know the minimum. So we're actually sort of – our protocols are actually pushing down our competency.
I think that goes back to having well-written protocols and staying on top of your medical directors or your protocol committees and keeping them up to date with the new evidence and with the new guidelines.
But who's researching, supposed to do that?
Right. Well, you're supposed to. I mean, I was researching a couple different protocols, just various pulling different systems, and I found one, and the last page in the protocol is a sheet that if you'd like to change a protocol, here's the steps and here's the form to fill out. You know, other than that, I know in my system we have every year or two a protocol committee that meets in their secret location, and they
underground bunker.
Yeah.
Right.
They meet with the medical control physicians, and they meet with, you know, each of the counties in my state, and, you know, they take back what, you know, each organization has to offer and combine them together. Does that make the best protocol? I don't know. I mean, I've seen better ones out there than we operate under.
But I mean, let me ask you this, though. I mean, do you find, Dave, that things like that, like having a committee every few years, that they're considering changing protocols because they want to try to get up to date with some newer research and whatnot and things like that. And is that type of committee sort of well advertised so that the masses get to know that that's happening, or is it just a secret thing that only a handful of people know, and it's the same handful of people that have been doing the protocols, you know, for years and years?
You know, Jim, it sounds like. It sounds like to me that we really were back to square one in just describing the protocols, with every protocol is a system around it that varies from county to county, state to state, all across this country, where there are some like that you were talking about that could be you can submit a form to say, hey, you know, there's something up with this protocol, or take a look at this information. And there are other places that, like Jim and I know, that hide in their secret bunker and do not, under any circumstance, question what is being given on the holy tablets.
I think my disclaimer, first off, is I think committees impede progress. You get a bunch of people together with all different levels of training and all different levels of education, and you either, if you're well educated and you've researched, you know, guidelines and, you know, the evidence, then you have to bring everybody else up to speed and convince them. And like you said, I think it was Jim, you said, you know, it's the same people all the time doing this.
I'm thinking of something now that's sort of just, it's hand-in-hand with protocol, but it's not quite, because how much protocol describes technique like venous puncture, okay? Whereas Jim and I were talking about dextrose and catheter size, and he said, oh, by the way, do you know? And he had read the pamphlet on one of his insertion packs, you know, how strange that we actually read that, and it recommends using the smallest catheter available to administer, this drug. And it's like, how many people do you know that do that with dextrose? They just, you know, the bigger the better.
Well, back to the committees. I think that I've worked in New York State, and I've also worked in the state where very close to where Dave works. And I think our state, first of all, we're kind of an outlier because we have fewer than a million people across the entire state, and we have fewer than 300 paramedics. So it's a lot easier to have a grasp of a smaller number of paramedics than there are in a lot of major cities. And it's easy to get the message out. There's a rollout. They explain, you know, they'll take each new protocol, and this is what we're thinking, this is what the evidence says. And it's not perfect, but I think it's better than a lot of other areas. And the paramedics do have input. They do, everything has to be based on some evidence. And one of the hindrances is, and I agree with Dave that committees do hinder progress. You have the higher performing paramedics on the committee. So they sometimes do things or word things that are above the level of the least competent paramedics in the system.
And Dave is probably talking, if I'm paraphrasing you, that, you know, committees aren't necessarily the evil, but what we find in most committees are more destructive than they are a hindrance to progress than they are an accelerant to progress. Is that fair, Dave?
Yeah. Yep, perfect.
Well, I mean, because most politically are political.
Oh, yeah, we got politicians
too. So,
I tell you, I think, you know, Dave, one thing you had mentioned is like with the one place you looked at that has a sheet at the back that gives people an opportunity to suggest a change in a protocol. And I'll tell you, I mean, honestly, if I had that ability, you know, a formal thing, a formal chain to submit a suggestion to, I would probably be doing it every time I did the protocol, and giving them links to research and you know, citing different, documents on what's better and where it's being used and all that good stuff. You know what I mean? But I think that I think there probably is in place for most regions that has some type of a step process that people can go ahead and suggest changes in the protocol. But I go back to what I said earlier, you know, when they're doing these changes, yeah, they have these chains of making a suggestion for a change in a protocol or in a procedure or something like that. It seems like all of that is like well hidden, tucked away someplace where you can't get at it. I mean, listen, New York City, and I do a lot of practice exams for New York City EMS, and one thing they do every year, they change the protocol. But before they change them, they send out sort of like a questionnaire on each protocol, letting everybody know that these are the changes coming up, and they're going to implement them on this date. But you can, by this date, you can go ahead and send us any concerns you have or comments you have on the proposed changes. Now, I never knew any of that was going on, years ago. You know, I only found out about it because I do what I do and I do a lot of research on it, and I came across it. So how many of the, like, again, how many of the masses are aware that these, you know, avenues of being part of the changes that go on are available to them? And then we get back to, again, kind of going around in the full circle almost, where without everybody being aware that the ability is there for you to be a part of this change, you get the same people who are making the decisions. And like you said, Josh, you know, a lot of it ends up being political, you know.
Well, that's what, you know, I was sort of laughing about when you were saying about the, you know, submission. The submission really is meant, you know, they do it on because they're a city government. Well, no, they're not, but they're sort of an agency, a private agency appointed by city government to do a certain thing, if I get the legalese.
Yeah, that's the gist of it.
It's something like that, okay?
Yeah.
But that's the gist of it. So they probably have to, like, when there's a job posting, post it to all. But the truth is they've already picked their, And you yourself know, I mean, because how many times you submitted things like, you know, grammatical errors, spelling errors, and how often have they changed them?
They change them after I do the protocol books. Once I'm done printing them all up, then they I can change.
That's why you're still doing the protocol books.
Listen, I don't know, guys. To me, it seems like almost it's very. I think it's frustrating for the average provider to go out there and say, hey, listen, I've been reading all of this stuff about dextrose, and you know, the D50 is not the best. We should be using D10. Some places they do it where they mix it in a bag and they just give it, you know, in a D5W type drip.
Only included.
You know, and it's like, where do they go? You know, it's like they talk to a doctor in the emergency room, but maybe the doctor's on board with them. They agree with them, but you know what? the doctor, it's trying to get them on board to kind of back you up and go to bat for you as the more educated voice, as the voice that is more on board with more recent, you know, research and whatever. It's difficult, you know, and it gets frustrating. And then we go back to, like I said earlier, it just, you go back to it, a point you get people who feel like they're getting beat down on it. And, you know, they just kind of just go along to get along, you know. And it gets to a point you can't blame them because they have so many things kind of ramping up against them that it's hard to sort of stick with it, you know.
I don't know if it's because it's hard, if that's an excuse. I mean, you know,
well,
and
not sort of
you
excuse,
know, let's
but...
wait, but let's back up. Let's take like a little bit, even though, you know, you've said it many times, this show is to look at issues, not to solve the problem. And, you know, we still have this organization within the government, federal government level, called DHS, which is apparently, as I understand, of late last year, now been appointed all of EMS across the country. I mean, has that actually happened, or was it only a suggestion? I thought it happened at a certain date.
I think they're still fighting about it.
But, you know, and there's a perfect, you know, those are the things that they control. They can't maybe control every state and every, you know, their particular protocols, but they can say, hey, you know, the standard of a state protocol is X. And then one of the things is open forum discussion of the protocol by the medical community. And having an open period on that protocol.
And Josh, I'll just take that a step further. I think that the biggest challenge to our progress is that we don't see what happens to our patients after we turn them over. And we don't see how our diabetic patients' blood sugars are out of whack a week after we treat them because we gave them D50 so fast. And we don't see what happens, you know, weeks, months, years later after we have patients on a non-rebreather mask. And then they stay on a non-rebreather mask in the hospital hallway before anyone notices them. We don't see those things. We don't have access to, you know, some people say it's a HIPAA violation. You know, we don't, a lot of paramedics aren't interested in following up on patients. They say, okay, well, I gave this cardiac arrestation epi and they have a pulse now, so that's good. And I gave them D50 and now they're awake. I gave them Narcan. And until we can actually get a grasp on the long-term effects, good and bad, of what we do for patients, and that's sort of communicated to the greater EMS community, that we're going to be stuck kind of having these discussions where, well, the protocol says to do this, you didn't do that. So whether it was good or bad for the patient, you're in trouble.
Well, I think, Bob, that goes into incorporating from a QA to a QI program, taking what we're seeing and then taking that back into training aspect on presenting it to your division. And, you know, obviously not all, you know, 100, 200,000 paramedics in the system are going to be able to see each and every patient's response and discharge paperwork, if you will. And you're going to have to figure out a, you know, system to get that information out as a whole. And I think that's encouraging the paramedics to, or EMTs even, to research. You know, I think in this day and age, I've said it before, I think, when I've called in, but, you know, during EMS week, GEMS was giving away a 2-year subscription to the magazine. And I think anybody who saw that and didn't take advantage of it, you know, it's just, it's ridiculous. There's a free resource. You know, pick an article, read it. You know, I mean, some of us are into reading it all the time and more so than others, but pick an article, read it, it will make you a better provider, and it will increase your interest in, you know, the research that's going on and staying up to date.
Yeah, I mean, it's a thing, too, like you said, Bob, about, you know, following up with patients and finding out what happens to them after the fact. You know, there's not enough of that that goes on, and when you've got a large population of paramedics and patients, it is hard for everyone to kind of get on board and figure that out and follow up with every patient. But I believe, you know, nowadays it should be easy to do a sort of a call review on certain patients, on certain medications, and put it on a company, you know, website that's viewable by employees only, that's viewable by the paramedics only. And you can omit patients' names and stuff like that and just go over, you know, the clinical end of it, you know, and let people see, okay, listen, this is what happened with this patient that we gave a full lamp of dextrose to versus this other patient that the paramedic decided that only, let's say, half an amp was what was required, and this is what happened to that patient. You know what I mean? And kind of give the providers a little bit of a view of the differences on what happens to patients, you know, when we're treating them. It shouldn't be up to the individual paramedic. It's hard for every individual med to go out there and follow up on their patients, and getting cooperation from hospitals to divulge that information all is difficult. But I think that should be up to management and, you know, the QA people to kind of provide that avenue, you know, for them, you know. Yeah, even with QA too, listen, I don't want us to bash QA up and down either. They have, I think, a vital role in what we do out there in the field. I mean, some people need QA. You know, it does point out shortcomings, ways you can do things better, and can catch patterns in people's treatments if they are, you know, not providing proper care. But, you know,
well, every good system needs feedback, Jim. And
yeah,
QA,
I mean,
is a form of feedback.
Right, exactly.
As
you have to have
may
it.
Not like
it. Right, exactly. And who does, right? Nobody wants to.
I mean,
you know,
because mostly it's QA is used. But again, you know, you have to talk about the system you're in. How is QA normally used? And everybody on this call is going to say it's normally used to find out who's deviating from a protocol and then to punish that person or correct that behavior if we don't want to use something as severe as punishment. But I want to know how many times you guys have gotten something back from QA that said, this was awesome work. This, you really helped this person.
Bob,
so, you know, QA...
Just us doing our job, right?
That's the way it's looked at. There's no, you know, in every single job, you know, they talk about appreciating the employees that are doing the work. You know, from a secretary of, you know, you're very efficient at being the face of this office, to you know, to a surgeon. You know, well, surgeons don't really need positive feedback, but you know. To line workers who are recognized for good product productivity. They get awards for that. You know? I mean, once a year we're sort of recognized by being the most prompt or, you know, having some ridiculous metric for that counts as a life saved. I mean, never mind. Don't get me started. That's another side issue.
Well, two things. One, as far as following up on patients, there are some states and who link their, it's an electronic reporting system, their PCR is electronic, and it syncs with the patient's chart. So you can look at, you can, from a computer in between calls, from your report, go into that patient's whole hospital course. You can follow up with them that way. So it's not a, it doesn't have to be a complicated thing. It's just some people are in those services are brave enough to push the HIPAA envelope and say that that's our patient as much as it is their physician's patient. And any physician in the hospital can, you know, patient comes in, they can look up their records from the last time they were there, and it's in their best interest, and it's in the community's best interest for us to be able to follow up on this. And it's not, you know, we've already had an intimate contact with that patient, so following up on what happens with them after is not a violation of their privacy.
Don't doctors do something like that right now?
Yeah, sure, absolutely.
Is there anything there for nurses? Does anybody here know? Where they review their patients?
I'm sure it must, you know.
Well, the other thing I've heard about nurses is keep in mind that nurses get somebody and there's a lot of palliative care from the point that they leave the hospital. So they see somebody throughout a treatment regime a lot. Now, granted, with medicine the way it is, people don't stay in hospitals as long as they used to, but they still get a lot more. I mean, ours is always segmented to the time of the time the patient is in transport. You know, most everybody else in the healthcare community has a longer touch on that patient. But I agree completely with Bob. You know, the, one of the big gaps that misses in our education and development is, you know, long-term feedback from, you know, for patient care.
Yeah, I think that when we talk about protocols, we talk about, you know, getting them changed to reflect more of current research and reflect more on what's better for the patients that we encounter. You know, it's hard for me to try to kind of figure out and to suggest what the first step is into getting these changes done. I mean, that's with anything pretty much in EMS. It's, you know, listen, somebody has to make the decisions, right? So we've got these committees that make the decisions on what to do. You know, when it comes to making changes and you know, updating protocols every few years or whatever, you get everybody's input into it, and everyone's screaming and yelling, and you get people who don't want to have any change at all, and some people who want to have extreme changes, and other people who want to keep stuff in there, sort of just in case, the just in case type, you know, line in the protocol that people just, they don't want to get rid of it because it's been there so long, they just want to kind of keep it as an option, you know what I mean? But somebody has to be able to make the final decision. So, I mean, for us in the field, the first step, of course, is you know, if you are looking at a protocol that you don't think is going to be beneficial to the patient, you want to withhold something or even give something additional that the protocol is not stating it. You know, for us, the first step is to contact medical control, you know, to get that approval done. You know, that's something we should be doing. I'm not advocating during this podcast to go ahead and just treat patients willy-nilly as, you know, to your whim. I mean, you've got to contact med control and bounce it, you know, by them. But the problem with that is that sort of at the same time, you kind of put that out there and you end up, you know, being told, no, go ahead and just give the entire dosage of something. You know what I mean? Or withhold something that you feel might be beneficial. You know, end up on that end of it too, where you get docs who don't trust EMS, don't trust what we're doing, and they'll be like, just follow the protocol and get the patient here.
Well, I had to defend the medical directors because they have some good reasons not to trust us. I mean, okay, suppose you have to call for orders for cardizem for someone in AFib, and a doctor had one paramedic one time give cardizem to someone who was septic and turned an urgent situation into a critical situation. And the doctors are in such, that you talk to on the radio, are in such a tough position because they have to, if they let you do something and it goes wrong, they're on the hook. If they don't let you do something, there's less risk, and they can probably justify why giving cardizem to someone in AFib might be dangerous, and, well, why don't we just transport them and, you know, we'll fix it when we get here. So I think that's something that we need to police among our coworkers. And, you know, I get very frustrated with medical control physicians, especially when they're new residents, who don't understand the role and haven't learned the role that EMS has and what we're capable of. But at the same time, that's a big weight on their shoulders. I can imagine they say, okay, go ahead and do something, and then you're kind of holding your breath until the patient gets here to see what they look like. So I see both sides. I'm frustrated by the side
well,
that I'm on, but I understand.
You know, but shouldn't our job be to give an accurate clinical picture? You know, something
Absolutely.
That somebody over... So that intern should be, you should be able to, between that intern asking the right questions and you giving the right answers, there should be a complete picture of what's going on with this patient to make that determination, in this case, whether or not they're actually AFib or septic, you know, well before, you know, the guessing game begins.
But the protocols, bad protocols, put those... thing. They're designed to be safeguards, but they really just make the whole thing a lot more complicated where, okay, giving someone Cardizem might be bad. Giving someone adenosine or, any dopamine might be dangerous. So we're going to want you to call. Well, those are usually pretty high-stress, low-frequency situations, or especially if you don't have experience, they're going to be stuttering on the phone talking to the doctor. You know, you might leave out an assessment thing. You might recognize something and know it, but forget to relate it when you're on the phone with them. So in a perfect world, yeah, you would be able to relate all the relevant information. The doctor would trust that that information is correct and that you haven't missed something. But, you know, there's a lot more human factors in play that I think we give credit for. And you watch Rory and Johnny on TV, that never happened. But, you know, when you're inexperienced and nervous and you're going to give adenosine for the first time, you know, even though I've done it in a cough, it's not a big deal to any of us anymore. But you know, the first time you do that and you're by yourself, you're going to be nervous. And if you have to call a doctor and ask permission for it, there's a good chance you're not going to sound, that nervousness is going to come through over the radio. And then you're the doctor. Are you going to let him do it? No, I don't.
Think we end up, you know, I think training is a part of it too. And letting doctors know that we have sufficient training and education to make these decisions and to make these clinical impressions when we're assessing our patients. But I think it goes back to, you know, the whole thing of protocols and about how they sort of, you know, set up to sort of deal with the weakest medic in the system that can get shaky on a call, not sure what to do, and if they follow XYZ in a protocol, they might not kill the patient that way.
That's how a well-written protocol should be able to respond. As it seems sort of strange to say a static document like a protocol to be able to respond, but a well-written protocol gives the direction with enough leeway to say we can vary from this if we need to.
Yeah.
And that's a big thing, and I think a lot of the protocols today still are missing that understanding that there's going to be certain competency levels in the field or competency levels in that patient communication that allow for, you know, deviation from what is usually written.
Yeah. Guys, I think I got Tim on the line, but I'm not getting anything but some feedback from him. Tim, I'm not sure if you can hear me, and I tried pulling you in here, but I'm just getting a lot of feedback. I'm not sure, maybe you're on the road trying to call in, so I'm not going to maybe hang up and call back, or I'm not really getting a great connection there. I think it was Tim anyway. It must be, just hung up. Well, listen, guys, I wish I could give the listeners, a step-by-step plan, you know, on how to go about changing their guidelines, you know, and give them something to kind of go on. Because this is such a frustrating topic, I think, for a lot of people, where they feel their hands are tied or they feel it, you know, they get in trouble when they try to do the right thing. I just wish it was something step-by-step we can give them. I got Tim back on. I don't have too much left tonight, but I'll maybe let Tim try to give his point of view real quick. Tim, you're a little bit better. I can actually hear you a little bit now.
Okay. If we need to call for command, why not just make us basic EMTs and not have us do anything? If the medical directors are putting such incompetent medics on the street that they don't trust them to make any decisions except choose from protocol A, B, or C, it's a multiple choice thing, then what's the point? Make them all BLS and admit that they don't know what medical direction is.
Amen.
Well, you know, and Tim, you know, but we've said that before, and the question is, where do we go, you know, because we're not all incompetent. Not everybody that touches a patient. You have to have the ability for that to work, forwards and backwards. And I can't hear a damn thing.
Okay, I think Tim's driving, so
they would get oversight should be at the hospital. And the doctor receiving the patient should be able to determine if the medic knows what they're doing and whether they did the right thing. And if the medics are doing the right thing, is there a reason for them to call in to say, Mother, may I do the right thing? Pretty please, it's only the patient's life that's at stake. Golly, why not this time? Don't you let me deviate from the textbook protocol that is written for the textbook patient because, well, the patient didn't read the textbook.
Because, Tim, anything important we all know happens in a hospital, okay?
Yeah, it's their patient already, and they're acting as if by waiting until the patient gets to the hospital, it's not their patient until they get to the hospital, which is completely untrue.
Yeah, I mean, listen, I know people, Tim, like you mentioned, that start feeling that they get so tired of constantly having to ask for permission for everything that they just go ahead and do the minimum and just get the patient to the hospital. But they feel they get that defeated sort of, of attitude of, why
exactly.
Am I even bothering?
It's not about the patient. It's about protecting their job. And is that what we want from EMS? And there are some places where that's exactly what they want from EMS. Their medical director, their bosses, we'll tell them, we don't want you to do anything that will create any liability. We don't care what happens to the patient, just don't make waves. And, some places that's what they want, but just admit that you're a BLS service then, and you occasionally start IVs, and you push drugs, but you don't know why. And,
the
patient I just had was bradycardic dropping down into the 30s. I didn't pace him. I didn't give atropine. He's on a beta blocker, on a calcium channel blocker, and on clonidine. I didn't give him Narcan for the clonidine because his breathing's adequate. All of these things are decisions that I made without contacting medical command because I'm going to talk to the doctor at the hospital and I'm going to take the time to explain what's going on. And I'm still going through the chart, assessing the patient the whole time. Should I really be interrupting my assessment of the patient to jump to a conclusion and call medical command about that because the medical director might be uncomfortable with what I might do because it's not specifically following the protocol? That's ridiculous. That's not good patient care. That's not the way to get somebody who's got any experience. After 1 year, the medic should have an idea of what they're doing. I'm not talking about 5 years, 10 years, 20 years, but a medic with 1 year should be able to make good decisions without calling medical command.
Tim, Dave Abel here. Does it say in your protocol, though, that, and we talked about it earlier before you joined in,
I think you broke up there, Dave.
Oh, no. It was the other guy.
You guys hear him away? Tim, you there?
I'm here. I lost Dave also.
Yeah, Dave, I lost you in the midway through your sentence there.
Oh, sorry about that.
That's
I was
right.
asking, in your protocol, Tim, does it have a protocol, if you will, what to do, what steps to take if you don't?
It says you should attempt to contact medical command. But, where do I prioritize contacting medical command while I'm starting an IV, getting a 12 lead, drawing blood, assessing vital signs, assessing the patient, going through the chart, doing all these things? At what point are we both treating and assessing at the same time and making decisions versus calling up, okay, yes, I do need to talk to a doctor. See if you've got one handy. I'll wait. We're only a few minutes out from the hospital anyway. If I don't want to do something, that is my best way of avoiding doing it. Call up and just have a protracted conversation with the medical command doctor and say, oh, too bad, I no longer need permission from you to not do the treatment because now we're in your parking lot and they're not getting the treatment anyway. So it's all in how you play the system. And that is exactly what we're told to do in some systems.
Yeah, I mean, I think Tim makes a good point, guy. That, you know, I think when you think about the protocols and calling the doctor, even calling to withhold something that you don't want to do, it does take up time, you know, away from the patient and away from your assessment and away from your everything you're supposed to do in the back of the ambulance in such a limited time frame that, you know, if you want to go ahead, and we mentioned this before, the way to sort of like bend the rules of, you know, telling your patient, you know, well, my system says I need to put you on the board, but if you sign here, I don't think you need it. You know, you sign here, and I won't do that to you. Or like you said, Bob, you know, about the dextrose, you give half an amp, the patient wakes up, you just document you gave an amp. And the same thing like Tim's saying, you can play dumb and then wait until you're 2 minutes from the hospital, call a doc and say, you know what, never mind, I'm almost here, so I'm going to hold off. I'm not going to give him anything. I'll be there.
Jim, what everybody is saying here and what nobody's saying is, and the least popular of all of these statements is, the bottom line is we are not doctors. We don't have that education. Regardless of how many years, how smart we are, there are aspects of patient care that we don't know and that a doctor does know. And there's the ultimate responsibility that lies with the doctor. So there's always going to have to be a level of guidelines. We're never going to have to have free rein in patient treatment.
Yeah. No, I agree. Like, and that's why I said before.
And nor should we.
I don't know. You know, I often wonder, like I said, I wish there was a way to get, you know, something together that providers could follow on sort of a step-by-step way for them to, you know, promote change in their local area, whether it's, you know, providing research, proof of research, who to talk to, you know, all that type of stuff. And to give people sort of a blueprint almost on, you know, how to get something changed that they know is better for their patient, it's better for the system that they're working in, you know, and it just overall better, wind up being better for EMS as a profession, you know, if it gets picked up every place, you know.
And
I know that this show is a lot of times it's mostly opinion. It's, you know, it's mostly opinions, and I put research links up and things like that, but, you know, and I like to try to at least give people some type of a guideline. So maybe I'll try to, you know, start working on that, and maybe in a year I'll have it together.
You know, wait a second. By discussing it, it becomes a talking point. By discussing amongst ourselves, by discussing this cast, you know, when you're at work with other people, of where do you think our protocols should be, other than what the local sports scores are or your favorite team or, you know, who's done what to who, you know, there is an aspect that we used to and sometimes still do talk about patient care, what we do. And I see, especially in a lot of organizations, the older medics, unless they've gone into a teaching role, refrain from that. It used to be, you know, you'd get on a job, and if you had a hot job, you'd talk it over with your partner. Now that doesn't happen all that frequently anymore, and there seems to be a culture of, you know, a culture of withholding information, not of sharing it and exchanging it, because we've become a very punitive group. So people are afraid to let go some information because it might be used against them.
Yeah. All right, guys, listen, we're a bit out of time. So guys, just want to maybe just take a minute, just maybe just give some final thoughts. And I'm sure we'll revisit this topic, you know, sooner than later. Bob, you want to go first?
Yeah, just follow. We didn't really get to this point. If you're going to break a protocol, just stop and ask yourself, are you doing it in the best interest of the patient, or is it, you know, out of laziness, like Tim said, or are you doing something that's reckless to satisfy your ego?
Right.
You know, just, if you're going to do something, just make sure it's in the best interest of the patient.
Absolutely. Dave, anything fine you want to add?
Oh, I think we have a long way to go before we get well-written protocols. I think we need to look into some standardization of them. And I really, you know, the reason for the blog post about the shades of gray, I unfortunately, when it comes down to it, in a court of law, they look at what's black and white. And,
yeah.
You know, I pulled up a case from North Carolina where they found a paramedic in violation of 13 different protocols. And when you read through it, it's amazing what they pick out in the courts. And it's sad this day and age that we worry about litigation, but that's what happens to providers who don't follow what's in the black and white. Make the protocols black and white and give the ability to have that self-clinician thinking process where you can make those decisions, but put it in your protocols to get it out there.
Yeah, enough with the mays and considers and things like that that don't make it clear cut, and then, you know, you end up getting questioned every time you do consider, you know what I mean? It's very true. Josh, anything you want to end with before we total up for the night?
No, you know what? Bob, Dave, and Tim have said it. We've said it before. What the solution is, you know, obviously a national umbrella of rules on how protocols are written, how they're disseminated, and how they're refined. There also has to be sort of a give and take within the EMS system that is a positive loop feedback to create better providers instead of a negative loop feedback. I don't think any proper system works with only one loop of feedback. You have to have positive and negative. Hell, you know, everything about medicine that we know, there's positive and negative feedback loops.
Yeah,
why
it seems
is it
like,
missing? Why is it missing here in EMS?
Yeah, it seems like a lot of it is punitive, and it's not a lot of, even negative feedback can be presented in a way that's constructive and not make it seem like, you know, you're being punished for doing something. Of course, there are cases that's gonna happen, but, you know, we're talking just on basic, you know, deviations and the no harm to patients and things like that. All right, guys, listen, I want to go on and on, so let's end it there. I'm sure we will revisit this topic again in some form or another. Guys, thanks so much for visiting me. Dave, I'll be sure to put a link to that blog post in the show notes so people can go check that out. Bob, if you have any links that you think are appropriate for the show, send them on over to me. I'll go ahead and put them in the show notes as well. So thanks a lot, guys, for joining me.
Thank you.
Well, great night, thanks.
Thanks for having us, Jim.
All right, guys, we really went a lot over tonight, but luckily I scheduled a little extra time in anticipation of the verbal fervor we were going to go through today. So thanks for joining me, guys. Listen, I hope you can get something out of this EMS Office Hours. I hope it does promote some thought process and help you maybe think about what you're doing out there in the field and how you can make things better for EMS, even if it's just in your local agency, on things you can do to make things better. If you have some office hour topics you want to see discussed here on the show, be sure to send them over to me. My email is jhoffman@ems-safety.com. I would love to go ahead and present a topic on something that you're passionate about in EMS, and we'll get the panel on here and talk a little bit about that. If you have some comments or questions on the show, be sure to post them in the show notes or visit us over at the main blog for previous episodes at emsofficehours.com. And until next week, guys, as always, Jim Hoffman, stay safe.